Lecture 2, Homer, Iliad.
I want to welcome you to the second of our lectures on the Great Books course, the Teaching Company's course on books that have made history, books that can change your life. In our first lecture, we explored the idea of what makes a great book. What is a book that can make history? What is a book that can change your life? We explored it through the person of the Lutheran pastor who, at the age of 39, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, met his death because of his beliefs and his conscience. His belief in absolute right and absolute good that must triumph over absolute wrong and absolute evil, that must triumph over the absolute wrong that was the Third Reich of Hitler. We also ask ourselves the question, how could Bonhoeffer and his SS judge who condemned him to death, Otto Thorbeck, lead radically different lives from reading the same great books? And certainly one of those books that they would have read was the Iliad. Not certainly would have read, they did read it. Both were the products of the classical German gymnasium, where the Iliad was the staple of instruction in Greek that every well-educated German should know. And in that, we come to our next lecture, which is about the Iliad. And the Iliad is an ideal book to begin our further exploration of the idea of a great book. We talked about the Iliad in my earlier course on famous Greeks. And in this course on books that have made history, we will go back to some of these treasured works, such as the Iliad, such as the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, but we will explore them from entirely new perspectives. Thus, in the great books discussion of the Iliad in our course on famous Greeks, we looked at it as a work of history. What does it tell us about the history of the age of Troy, of the age of Mycenae? And we saw that the Iliad was indeed a work of history, that it possessed a strong kernel of historical accuracy, a remembrance of the great events that led to the sacking of Troy and to the collapse of the civilization of Mycenae. In this course, we want to ask ourselves, what in the Iliad still speaks to us today, not of history, but of our own lives? What are the themes of the Iliad? In this course, which we have built around themes that are so important in our individual lives, it is not as though every book gives us one specific theme that we can go to a card catalog and say, oh, let's look up justice. This is the book we ought to read. No. What makes these books great is the fact that they speak to theme after theme after theme. And nowhere is this more true in the Iliad. But the fundamental theme of Homer in the Iliad is God. God and fate and the meaning of life. And God and fate for Homer are means by which you come to the meaning of your life. The Iliad is a truly great work. It certainly speaks across the ages. It was composed by a single creative genius, Homer, as the Greeks well understood, who sometime around 800, perhaps as late as 750 BC, in Asia Minor, what we would call Turkey today, composed this magnificent song. 15,693 lines, the epic of the Iliad. Iliad means the tale of Ilion, the tale of Troy. It is a narrative poem telling the story of just a few days within that great struggle between Trojans and Greeks. It was a book that, for the Greeks, had the same role that the Bible once had in American society. It was where you looked for moral instruction. It was also a book written in the most sublime of poetry. And there were Greeks who knew the whole of the Iliad by heart. and for the romantic poets of the 19th century like Keats. Once again, Homer was unsurpassed for the beauty of his language. Why, it was to open a whole new world just to read the Iliad, even in translation. For the British Prime Minister, the liberal Prime Minister Gladstone in the 19th century, the Iliad was a book of moral instruction without equal. In fact, he wanted the whole educational system at Oxford reformed so that you just read the Iliad and the Odyssey. There you would find all the lessons you need to live your own life and to be ruler of that empire upon which the sun never set. So a book of unsurpassed moral wisdom. And still in the 20th century and on into our own century, students have read it in Western civilization courses, in Greek epic and translation courses, and it is a book that makes me sometimes ponder the third of our definitions of a great book. It certainly has a great theme, the meaning of life. It is certainly written in noble language, but does it still speak to us today? As I watch students, perhaps some of you, struggling with all of the elaborate similes, with the names, with the mythological references that are not explained. I think the best way to come to the Iliad, in fact, is to start by reading books 1 and books 24. And book 1 of the Iliad is a masterpiece. For Homer understood that it was not his task to tell the whole of the story of Troy. That story began with a quarrel among the gods and goddesses over who was the most beautiful. Remember, there was a banquet of the gods and goddesses in heaven, and every god and goddess had been invited except the goddess of discord. And she, jealous and upset that she had been excluded because of all the disharmony she caused, rolled into the banquet hall a golden apple, and on it was written, "To the fairest." Well, every goddess there reached for it, of course. And three were absolutely certain that this was their apple. Aphrodite, the goddess of love, Hera, the queen of the gods, and Athena, that goddess of wisdom, and that mighty warrior goddess. They went to Zeus, and they said, "You've got to decide, king of the gods, who is the fairest." Well, Zeus is a very wise man, and like any good CEO, commanding these divinities, but having to listen to what they say, he passes it on down to a fall guy. Isn't that what you do as a good CEO? You pass it on down to a fall guy. And the perfect fall guy is a shepherd out in the wilds around the land of Troy, out in Ilion, Paris. And Paris, very handsome man, is stupid enough to accept this choice. So they come down and the three goddesses all make him offers of bribes. Athena will make him a mighty warrior and lead him in conquest. And Hera will make him ruler of the world, and Aphrodite promises him the most beautiful woman. Well, he chooses Aphrodite. Now, that right there is a stupid decision, don't you think? Well, no, really. If you're the most powerful person in the world, you'll be a mighty warrior, and you can have any woman you want. Isn't that true? Of course it's true. But he makes that foolish decision, and so he incurs not only against himself, but against his country, against Troy, the wrath of Hera and of Athena, and they will not relent until he is destroyed and until Troy is gone. Paris then has to claim the most beautiful woman in the world. Goes off to Sparta in Greece. Now, once again, this is a stupid decision. He is told that Helen is the most beautiful woman in the world, but she's already married. Well, surely he could take another step and say, "Well, I'll take the second most beautiful." But no, he goes off and Helen is willing to elope with him, the wife of Menelaus. Well, they come back to Troy, and outraged in his honor, Menelaus calls upon all of his fellow Greek warrior chieftains to honor their pledge that if Helen marries him, they will all come in his defense and fight to win her back if she ever leaves him or is taken away. So a mighty host is arrayed, 1,186 ships, led by the brother of Menelaus, great Agamemnon, king of the most powerful city of Mycenae, made king and commander by Zeus himself. But the great fleet comes together, prepares to sail to Troy, and it can't move. The winds won't blow. So recourse is made to a soothsayer. Why won't the winds blow, O one who can see into the future, O prophet Calchas? It is because the gods and goddesses are outraged. A little tiny bunny rabbit was killed by your hunting dogs while she was pregnant, and they killed mother and babies. That's how much the gods care about small things. So to avenge that outrage of the innocent, an innocent must be offered in sacrifice. And that innocent is your daughter. It is Iphigenia, O great Agamemnon. What has Iphigenia done to deserve any of this? Well, once again, Agamemnon has the choice. Does he have to offer up his daughter? No, we can go back to Mycenae and say somebody else lead the great armada. But no, he wants that glory and victory. And so his own daughter is brought under a lie that she will wed the mightiest of the warriors, great Achilles. And when she arrives, the deceit is uncovered and hard-eyed men put her to death. Cut her throat. Hang her up to drip on the blood and flesh offered up to the gods in sacrifice. But the winds blow, and the great fleet now arrives at Troy. And for 10 long years they sit there, waging war. The Trojans too bound by honor to give up Helen, and the Greeks too bound by honor to go back. In other words, what began as an expedition to retrieve honor and a preemptive strike, wouldn't you say? After all, if Helen has been taken away, what next thing will the Trojans do? So a preemptive strike in the Middle East turns into a 10-year war with suffering that no one could imagine. And that is where Homer begins his story, in this 10th year of the war. But such is his poetic genius that he chooses one moment in that war to crystallize all the great themes. Meninaide thea peliadi o Achilleos, he begins. Of the wrath, of the anger of Achilles, sing, goddess. That anger that sent the Greeks by the thousands to death, sending their souls down into the underworld and left their bodies to be food for the dogs and vultures. For thus was the will of Zeus accomplished. And the Iliad is the story of the anger of Achilles, of his outrage over the wrong done to him by Agamemnon, who takes away his slave girl in response to an order from the gods. In other words, Agamemnon following his duty as he sees it given to him by the gods, and Achilles defending his honor. And Achilles withdraws from the fight. And without this mightiest of warriors, the Trojans come close to absolute victory, driving the Greeks almost into the sea. And to save the honor of Greece, once again, this word honor, the closest friend, the dearest friend, the man he loves, Patroclus, the friend of Achilles, puts on the armor of Achilles and goes out to fight, and dies at the hand of the noblest of all the Trojans, at the hands of great Hector. And Hector strips away his honor, his armor, and with it the honor of Patroclus, and wears it into battle. Now, motivated by the death of his friend, by the grief that cannot be put aside, Achilles goes out into battle and kills mighty Hector in hand-to-hand combat. And now so driven, not only by honor, but by anger, that when Hector asks, if I kill you, I will give your body back to your friends. Do the same for me, Achilles says, no. There can be no peace between you and me. I wish I could eat your heart raw. Hector is killed, and Achilles drives him around and around and around the walls of Troy, before the eyes of his mother, his father, his family, his wife, his small baby child, outraging the person of Hector. To such extent has this war, this preemptive strike in the Middle East, brought these two great nations. But the aged father of Hector goes to Achilles, aided by the gods, who themselves understand that this has gone too far, and ask simply that his son be returned. And Achilles, seeing in this old man the image of his own father that he hasn't seen for 10 years, gives back the body of Hector. And the Iliad, this story of these few days of wrath and honor and of outrageous arrogance, ends with the funeral of Hector. Thus they celebrated the funeral rites of Hector, breaker of horses. The Iliad ends, you see, as all of our lives must end, with death. For Homer, the supreme theme is the meaning of our lives. Why are we here? Why all this suffering and warfare, if even the greatest of figures like Achilles can find no comfort even in the glory of their arms? Why is war waged? Why do the innocent suffer? All of this is for Homer the central question. The Iliad is the first work of Greek literature. It is the work most revered by this most creative of people, the ancient Greeks. And in it, this supreme creative genius, Homer, asks us to face that question, which is as real to us today as it was around the walls of Troy. It is a question that begins with God. Thus was the will of Zeus fulfilled. That is what Homer tells us at the very beginning of the poem, in his first great line of sentences. Thus was the will of Zeus fulfilled. Who are the gods of Homer? Homer was a polytheist. That is, he believed in many gods. Monotheist believes in one god. The polytheist believes in many gods. And for Homer, divinity is not just Zeus, but Hera, Aphrodite, Athena, Ares, the war god. All of these are very real creatures. And it is our modern mistake to believe that these are silly little creations of mythology that Homer could not have taken seriously. They are very real. They embody powerful forces. The polytheist defines a divinity as a power capable of rendering supernatural benefits to the community. And these are all powers that can do good for you or do great harm to you. So first put aside your idea that mythology is meaningless. Mythology is simply another means for expressing a higher truth. That is what a myth is, a means for expressing a higher truth. And in the person of Zeus in the Iliad, Zeus who is king of gods and men, Zeus who perhaps can control fate itself, we see the seeds of a development that will lead to an idea of God as one all-powerful and all-controlling. The seeds of a later monotheism are there in Homer's picture of an all-powerful Zeus. Zeus can control fate, but he chooses not to. So God is real to Homer. And God sends evil upon humans. It was the will of Zeus that the Greeks and Trojans suffer around the walls of Troy. It was the will of Zeus that the Greeks suffer because of the outraged honor of Achilles. And it was the will of Zeus that Hector, a good man, a mighty warrior, who had always paid the gods their dues, must die and be outraged in such a fashion. And it was the will of Zeus that Troy be fated to destruction, that not just its men be killed, but that its women and children be sold into slavery. All of that was the will of Zeus. Fate, then, is what the gods decree for us. the gods in their power, and the gods in their knowledge. That is the first step for Homer in your uncovering the meaning of your life. There is good and there is evil. And men and women make conscious decisions about good and evil. And therein lies the course by which you give meaning to your life, the decisions that each of us make. Agamemnon, having captured the great city of Troy, as Homer well knows, will go back home to death. His wife will murder him, along with the lover that she has taken during his long absence at Troy. She will murder him because he murdered their daughter. He offered up Iphigenia in sacrifice. Now that deed was evil. It represented the act of hubris. And for the Greeks, hubris is that great moral wrong. It is outrageous arrogance, is the definition for hubris. Outrageous arrogance by which power is abused to inflict pain and wrong upon the innocent. And Agamemnon committed hubris by offering his daughter up in sacrifice. You say the gods ordered him to. Well, after all, Hitler ordered Otto Thorbeck to go and pass judgment upon Dietrich Bonhoeffer. That SS judge could have said no, and Agamemnon could have said no. But don't you see, he knew what the meaning of his life was. It was to lead this great army against Troy and conquer it, wasn't it? Yes, indeed. To conquer Troy and to burn it and to come back to glory such as no Greek had ever known before. Thus the gods had made him blind. Ate, moral blindness. That is the absence of a moral vision that leads you to commit hubris. Homer tells us, a sense that you are so right, that you know so well your course in life, that you will commit actions that outrage the innocent. And the gods never forget this outrage. The judgment will come. Agamemnon might live to come home from Troy, but he will die. That is the lesson of Troy. That is the lesson of Homer. The gods care about good and evil. There is absolute right and there is absolute wrong. And the gods ultimately punish what is wrong as they reward what is good. But the trouble is that mortals are so blinded, they so lack vision, that they cannot understand what is good and what is evil. Until it is too late. That too is a central lesson of Homer. We do not understand the ways of the gods. His book is a means of our beginning to gain some wisdom. But he would have agreed with the Bible that the fear of the gods is the beginning of wisdom. Take the gods seriously. Take seriously the omens they send into the world. Don't dismiss them as some literary critic might, but take them seriously as the means by which the gods make their will known. Ultimately, the Iliad is a book about the meaning of life and how to gain the wisdom to lead that life. It is the story of the education of Achilles. He had been given every great attribute that a Greek admired. Young, handsome, the mightiest warrior of his day. And to him had been given the opportunity to fight for eternal fame around the walls of Troy, to fight for his country in a war that was just. After all, the Greeks were but going to get back what was Menelaus's, Helen. So a war of honor, a just war, and Achilles is the leader. Yes, Agamemnon is the commander-in-chief, but everyone knows that Achilles is the greatest warrior. And he's made a choice early in his life. His mother was divine, his father a mortal, and his mother had given him the choice. This goddess had given him the choice. Do you want to live a long life? Do you want to grow up and be, I don't know, a CPA in Norfolk, Virginia? Make a lot of money. Or do you want to die young and live a life of glory and leave behind a reputation as the greatest man of your day? And without hesitation, he chose glory. So he had made his choice. And that glory and honor was to give meaning to his life. And he lived his life with these values of honor and glory. Honor. For Achilles, it is the most central of all values. Honor is having a reputation for truth, for keeping your word, for taking vengeance upon those who wrong you, for defending yourself, defending the weak. And honor is not only what you think about yourself. Honor is what others think about you. And when Agamemnon strips away his slave girl, he has been dishonored. He refuses to fight. And then he goes back into the field in defense of his friend to avenge his friend and kills great Hector. Now that's honor for you, is it not? But then, as he sits in his tent and looks at this old man, Priam, who has come to reclaim his son, Achilles finally gains wisdom. Yes, he wants honor, but honor can come at too high of a price. Honor can be bought at the price of that which is dearest to you, your friend's life. In other words, honor can be pushed too far. And therein Homer speaks to us still today. Oh, we're not warriors today. And honor, why, when somebody tells you, you know, that man is an honorable man, you really want to watch out for them. Honor simply doesn't exist today. You get mad at you, me, if you will, but it just doesn't. But each one of us has something that we prize. It may be wealth. It may be reputation. And we will do anything to get that and to hold on to it. It may be power. But moderation in pursuing your values, that is the lesson that Achilles has learned. That is his wisdom. Moderation, nothing in excess. In fact, that was what was over the lintel, over the doorway as you walked into Delphi, the shrine of the great god Apollo. Nothing in excess, and know yourself. Know that you are mortal, and know that there are things that you can push too far. Even a good cause can be pushed too far. But how did Achilles learn this lesson? Did he learn it by listening to a teaching company course? No. He learned it by suffering, by the loss of what was dearest to him, his friend Patroclus. That too was a central lesson of the wisdom of the Greeks. We only learn wisdom through suffering. That is why generation after generation must read these same books, must repeat these same eras, must fight the same war over and over again, because Zeus has willed that mortals only learn wisdom by suffering. And what is wisdom? I've told you it is to push something not too far, to be moderate in all things. But you will come back and say to me, but look at Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He pushed his idea of justice so far that he got himself killed. And he left his family to suffer. That's why the great books are not easy to learn. But true wisdom knows when to push a thing so far that other ordinary mortals are going to say, but you're excessive. Thus, you must have the wisdom to know How far is too far? And Achilles, there on the plains of Troy, gives us that first great lesson in wisdom and the meaning of life. His life was to gain as much glory as possible. He was going to die in the end, but it was how he lived his life in the meantime that mattered. And that is a lesson we can all take with us.